The all-new Toyota RAV4 asks, what if? What if your ride was refined and rugged at the same time? Introducing the all-new RAV4 Hybrid. 208 combined horsepower and standard all-wheel drive make it the most powerful RAV4. Plus, with its head-turning style and breakaway speed, it's bound to change the way you think of a hybrid. The all-new RAV4 Hybrid. Toyota. Let's go places. Horsepower. Ratings achieved using the required premium unleaded gasoline with an octane rating of 91 or higher. Premium fuel is not used. Performance will decrease.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today, we're going to be talking about tips for getting pregnant with IVF. IVF obviously stands for in vitro fertilization. I'm Dawn Davenport, the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. We're a weekly radio show and we utilize the podcast model. That way you can listen whenever and wherever you want. You can also subscribe to the podcast to get notice of each new episode on whatever listening device you are utilizing. And you can subscribe either through iTunes or, again, whatever app you're currently using on your phone or your tablet or your computer. Type in our name and there's a subscribe button and click it and you will be subscribing to us. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring is pleased to offer their IVF Greenlight program, providing discounts of up to 50% on select IVF products. All cash-paying patients are eligible, and unlike other programs, there are no financial requirements. To get more information, you can go to their website, ivfgreenlight.com. This show, as well as all the extensive resources we provide on this topic, IVF, as well as other forms of infertility treatment, as well as coping with infertility, the emotional upheavals that it will cause. So all of these resources could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create their family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years and are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical as well as personal information on their donors. Only 1 in 200 applicants make it through their screening process to become a donor. We also have Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility with 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey. They maintain an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. We also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to adoption as well as assisted reproductive law, including providing a gestational surrogacy matching program as well as legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation. And Manhattan Cryobank. They have been dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of the prospective sperm donor to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. In addition to sperm donor services, Manhattan Cryobank also offers a full range of andrology and fertility preservation services. We have other wonderful sponsors. Those were some of our gold sponsors. We also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption or an infertility service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories on our service provider page and on our site. You can search by a number of factors, location, services provided, and other things that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today we're going to be talking about tips for getting pregnant with IVF, and specifically we're going to be talking about some of the medical breakthroughs that have been happening that are increasing the odds of success when using in vitro fertilization as well as other forms of infertility treatment. Our guest today is Dr. Marcy McGuire. She is a reproductive embryologist at the Reproductive Medical Associates of New Jersey and a clinical assistant professor of reproductive endocrinology at the Robert Woods Johnson Medical School. This is a re-airing of a show that we aired 2 years ago. It has been a very popular show, and the information is still relevant, and I think you will find it as fascinating as others have found it, and we are pleased to be able to bring it to the fore again to increase more attention upon this really important topic. Let's face it, IVF is not inexpensive, and you want to really think through carefully everything you can do to increase your odds of success. And without further ado, I bring you Dr. Marcy McGuire.
Welcome, Dr. McGuire, to Creating a Family.
Thanks, Dawn. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so in order to achieve a pregnancy with IVF, we need good embryos to transfer. I guess that seems pretty obvious. And it seems, actually, it struck me over and over again at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine conference that we just got back from a couple of weeks ago. It seemed like we're entering a new world and looking at what makes a good embryo. In the past, we talked about it being embryo selection was more art than science. And it just seems to me from listening to the researchers and reading some of the papers and seeing some of the poster presentations that the new research that's coming out seems to be changing that equation more towards the science end. So I think it would help if we first talk about, kind of at the very beginning, what makes a good embryo? And by good, let me be really clear here, I mean one that will implant and grow for 9 months to become a baby.
Absolutely. There are actually multiple factors that lead to a good embryo, a strong embryo that would ultimately lead to delivery of a live birth, a healthy child. The most important factor is the genetics of the embryo. Aneuploidy, or an abnormal number of chromosomes, is the leading reason that couples have either a failed pregnancy, meaning a negative pregnancy test, or a miscarriage. So that's far and above the most important factor in defining a good embryo. But there are other non-genomic factors as well, including energy sources within the embryo and other factors leading to its ability to divide and grow.
So we kind of have the genomic type factors, the genes, and then are the chromosomal issues, and then we have others, other issues. Okay, so we'll kind of talk around all of those. All right, let's start with the most common one, and that is, as you mentioned, where there's a chromosomal abnormality. What causes embryos to have an abnormal, is it usually a number issue, an abnormal number of chromosomes? Is that the usual chromosomal or genomic type problem?
Correct. So all cells have, 22 autosomal chromosomes plus a pair of sex chromosomes. And during the process of reproduction, new cells are generated which should have an appropriate number of 22 autosomes plus an X and an X for a female or an X and a Y for a male. And during this process wherein embryos are created, then there can be errors so that there aren't exactly 22 autosomes and an X and a Y or an X and an X, that there is an extra chromosome 21, for instance, which would lead to Down syndrome, or perhaps a missing part of chromosome 5. Other errors that make the cell or the embryo somewhat imperfect genetically, and then this embryo then becomes unable to make to a live birth, and sometimes unable to even lead to a pregnancy.
Are chromosomal errors more common in IVF than they are in the typical way people get pregnant?
They're not more common in IVF. However, there is an age correlation with the risk of aneuploidy in embryos, so that as women get older, the chance of having an aneuploid embryo or an embryo that is not genetically normal increases, and this risk grows exponentially after age 35, so that when a woman nears the age of 40, then a significant portion of her embryos would be likely to be genetically abnormal. So they may appear normal just on the surface, but actually within, the genetics of that embryo are not sound, and that embryo would not have the potential to lead to a delivery.
You mentioned women's age. What about men's age? What if the woman is below 35? And I realize there's no magic cutoff, but let's say,
right,
for sake of argument, let's choose 35. If the woman was below 35, but the man was, in his 40s or 50s. our 60s.
So paternal age is less critical, but does have some influence. So increasing paternal age does not appear to be as closely linked with chromosomal problems, but can be linked with other possible genetic issues, for instance, autosomal dominant disorders, possibly, and some have also suggested a possible link with autism. But
yeah,
But there, it's definitely closely tied to the risk of aneuploidy or abnormal chromosomes is definitely closely tied to maternal age.
Yeah, it's just one of those unfair things.
Totally.
But it is,
yeah.
It is what it is. All right, so it's not more common in IVF, but we would then know about it. Now, the chromosomal errors that we've talked about, would they affect the embryo from implant, because I guess there's a number of things that have to happen. First, the embryo has to implant into the uterine lining. Then the embryo has to grow and sustain itself and make it through the full 9 months. So where do the chromosomal issues raise their become the biggest problem for the implantation or the growing or the what?
Absolutely. So that can chromosomal errors can manifest throughout. Aneuploid embryos or chromosomally abnormal embryos may simply arrest in the culture dish in the IVF laboratory. They may not even make it to the stage where they would be transferred into an endometrium. On the other hand, they may be transferred and then never lead to a positive pregnancy test. They may never actually implant. Then they will implant and then develop until somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks gestation. And that's probably the most unfortunate case because couples get their hopes up and they, you know, are certainly pregnant and then there's a fetus there but the heart rate disappears or something like that and they end up having a miscarriage. And chromosomal abnormalities are certainly commonly found among the products of conception past at the time of miscarriage.
Yeah. All right, so then before we move off of talking about the different factors that make a good embryo, you mentioned the energy source within the embryo. That obviously, I guess it's obvious that embryos need an energy source to further their division and implantation and growth and all that. So what do we know about the energy source and how does that impact?
Right, exactly. There is actually much less known about the non-genomic sources of failed embryo implantation or failed embryo development, meaning that if a euploid or a genetically normal embryo is transferred, why would it, A, not implant at all, or B, develop but ultimately lead to a loss? And reasons to explain this phenomenon are more theory than fact at this point. But at least in theory, there could be issues related to the embryo's energy to continue to divide and grow, which is a highly energy-consuming activity. And then also there are receptors on the embryo surface and also on the surface of the endometrium, which come into play and have an effect on whether that pregnancy would implant and grow. So there are multiple non-genomic factors that are related to the success of a successful pregnancy outcome following IVF, but it's much harder to define these.
Well, and another one you mentioned was that I wanted to follow up on was the division and division. You didn't say division rate, but that's what I was thinking. I know that there has been some interesting research done a number of years ago on videotaping or watching in some way embryos and seeing what their rate of division is, and that was felt to be indicative or an indication that these embryos would go or were thriving in the dish, in the petri dish, and so then therefore would be expected to thrive inside the uterus. Is that research continuing, or has that become standard, or has that been disqualified, found to be not valid?
Absolutely. So that research is continuing, although not accepted as standard of care at this point. RMA actually recently did a collaborative study using a time-lapse photography method of watching or observing embryo development in culture. And the goal of that study was to look at whether this pattern of development correlated with embryo aneuploidy or not. And the results of that study are still pending, but it is an idea that has been discussed to a great extent. There is a theory called the quiet embryo theory that perhaps the embryos which need slightly less energy could potentially have better chance at success. But again, that's a theory that is being investigated.
Yeah, I mean, we want all the answers right now, or maybe I'm speaking for myself.
Right.
It's like I hear something and I think, okay, well, okay, what's the answer?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, research doesn't work with the snap of a finger, which is,
right.
You know, really unfortunate
right.
for all of us. All right, so going back to some of the exciting developments that are happening, and it seems to be happening all right now, which I realize is not true. These have been ongoing, and they're continuing, and every year it's probably the case, but it just seems that this was the year of the embryo for me. So what are some of the research that we are seeing now that's coming into fruition and actually being utilized in IVF practices, I mean infertility practices, that are helping doctors and embryologists pick the best embryos to transfer?
Absolutely. So just like you said, in prior years, we were forced to select embryos for transfer based purely on aesthetics, how they looked from the outside. And unfortunately, the aesthetics of an embryo do not always predict its potential to lead to a baby. So that sometimes relatively good-looking embryos may not lead to a pregnancy, whereas somewhat, forgive me for saying this, but somewhat ugly embryos lead to a perfectly normal, healthy child.
Mm-hmm.
So now our technology has advanced to the point where we can biopsy the placental cells of an embryo and do genetic testing on the embryo prior to transfer, and that will help us to gain better pregnancy rates because we are able to know the genetic identity of the embryos before even transferring them into a woman's uterus. So
and that
in
process,
the past,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was
in the
say,
past,
that process is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. People may have heard it referred to as PGD. So I just wanted to throw that out there. So go ahead. I interrupted.
Absolutely. So PGD testing historically was actually done on day 8, which is a cleavage stage embryo, at which point there are only 8 cells. And the biopsy for that type of testing required taking 1 or 2 cells out of an 8-cell embryo and thereby potentially doing some damage to the embryo's ability to implant itself. But now we're able to grow the embryos to the blastocyst stage where they are approximately 200 cells and have a distinct inner cell mass or a portion that will lead to the baby ultimately, which is separate from the trophectoderm cells around the edge, which will ultimately lead to the placenta. So by growing the embryos to blastocyst stage, we can identify which cells are placenta and take a few cells from the placenta portion of a now 200-cell embryo, therefore not doing damage to the embryo through the biopsy itself, and then use these increasingly rapid technologies to look through, so to speak, the chromosomes of each embryo to determine which ones have a normal genetic content versus ones that have extra or missing chromosomal material.
And historically, it used to be done on what day? What day was 8-cell?
So that's day 3 typically, and that is still done by some clinics. However, the blastocyst stage biopsy likely offers an advantage in terms of allowing the embryo better implantation capacity.
And generally speaking, the blastocyst stage is around day 5 or day 6? Day 5 probably, huh?
Correct, day 5 to 6.
Okay. All right, just so we kind of know what type of... And what's fascinating to me is that because one of the concerns, and some of the research was fairly optimistic, but one of the concerns is if you've got 8 cells to choose from and you're taking 1 or 2, let's say 2, that what happens to the resulting embryo? they are dividing, but is it possible that, either it would hurt the embryo and it wouldn't become a child, or that if a child was created from this embryo, it would hurt the child? And that didn't necessarily, I don't know that we know for certain that that's the case, but it certainly, is there any evidence, maybe I should ask that, is there any evidence that says that it is safer for the embryo and or ultimately the child to remove a couple of, from 200 from a couple, rather than removing a couple from 8?
Correct, yes, and definitely an important point. So to the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of an adverse effect on the children born from the biopsy. So if the embryo is to survive the biopsy and ultimately lead to a live birth, I'm not aware of any damage or harm that's done to the resulting children. However, a study done at RMA has shown that a cleavage stage biopsy will result in lower implantation rates for the embryo than a blastocyst or trophectoderm biopsy, which is the type of biopsy done on day 5 to 6.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, well, it seems like we have a problem here, though, because most embryos are transferred. If you're transferring at the blastocyst stage, you're transferring at day 5. But if you're also taking the biopsy of the placenta cells at day 5, that means you're not able to transfer at day 5. So how do we work around that timing issue?
Absolutely. So actually, with newer technology, microarray, and now RMA uses qPCR testing, we're able to obtain the biopsy and then within a 4-hour window get the genetic information. So we actually can have the capacity to do a biopsy and then transfer it all within a fresh cycle.
Interesting. So 4 hours, wow.
Yeah.
That's quick. All right, we do have a question here from Sue Ellen. It may be a bit of a moot question at this point. She says, mm-hmm. Do you have to freeze embryos to do this and then do the transfer at another appointment? I worry about how freezing might affect the embryo and later baby and would like to avoid it. She's asked a couple of questions here. One's the impact of freezing on embryos. But I guess let's start with the question of, you've pretty much answered it. You do not have to freeze an embryo in order to do PGD, even if you wait until day 5 or day 6 to biopsy and get the cells and do the testing. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we usually do our fresh transfers on the morning of day 6. So the biopsy would be done either on the day 5 or day 6 and a transfer early in the morning of day 6.
And there is some research, though, that would indicate that it's not only not harmful to not transfer fresh, but that you might have increased pregnancy rates if you freeze the embryos and transfer not when the woman has just been had the egg retrieval just prior days in that same month. So how do you analyze whether to do a fresh transfer or freeze? That kind of goes to Sue Ellen's question, which is, preferring to do fresh, and that's fine to prefer it. I just wonder if that's supported by science.
Right, absolutely. And another very hot topic at ASRM this year. So there are two issues to consider at that point. One is the window of implantation. So from the moment a woman's uterus is first introduced to progesterone, there is a limited time frame during which an embryo can be transferred, and that's called the window of implantation. So for a normally developing embryo, that can be transferred on the morning of day 6 or on day 5 if you're doing a blastocyst transfer, and still remain within the window of implantation. If, however, the embryo is doing okay but kind of growing slow so that it's just passing from the morula stage into the blastocyst stage when it really should be a fully expanded blastocyst by this, then it is now out of sync with the lining of the uterus, because on the morning of day 6, the uterus is really ready for an expanded blastocyst. That's what it's prepared for, and it doesn't necessarily want to accept a slowly developing or an at that point underdeveloped embryo. So in that kind of situation, it makes sense to, you know, give the embryos a little more time so that they can get to the blastocyst stage where they need to be to optimize their chance for implantation. That be, if that is done, though, you will have bypassed that window of implantation, that the uterus will have sort of passed you by, so to speak. So we couldn't effectively transfer that slower-growing embryo because we would have missed our opportunity. But that's okay because you can just freeze the embryo at that point and transfer the following month when everything is lined up.
That makes it, I like that, that gap of getting out of sync with the embryo, out of sync with the uterus. That's a great analogy. And is there some also evidence to support that the use of the gonadotropins themselves or the medications that are taken to stimulate a woman's ovary to produce more eggs than would normally happen can also affect the woman's uterine lining and perhaps make it less supportive? Therefore, if you wait a month, the uterine lining might be more nurturing, ripe, whatever the correct word is. Does that hold any water when we look at it scientifically?
Absolutely. There is definitely data to suggest that a hyperstimulated uterus or a hyperstimulated estrogen milieu is not the optimal environment for embryo transfer. Scientists have looked at women who've had exceedingly high estradiol levels or estrogen levels during fresh IVF cycles and either A, had their embryos transferred anyway despite that high estrogen level versus B, had an embryo transferred the following month during a frozen cycle when their estrogen levels were more physiologic, more within the normal range. And mm-hmm. there is some evidence to suggest that at least obstetric outcomes are worse if the embryo is transferred into a hyperstimulated high estrogen environment. Those obstetric complications might include preeclampsia and other issues like that.
I was just going to ask what obstetric outcome, what you meant by that, but preeclampsia is the primary one.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Okay, excellent. All right, so you mentioned that qPCR, is that the, did I get that right? That's the testing that you utilize?
Correct, yes.
The PGD. All right, so we have the general kind of category of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis testing. Under that, what options do people have? A PGD is, we've thought about it in the past, as a, you know, you do PGD, you don't then have the thought of when you're selecting a lab of what type of PGD. So are there different
right.
types? But it sounds like now there are different types of PGD, and if so, what are they?
Absolutely. So FISH was probably the first technology used for some PGD screening for aneuploidy in embryos. However, unfortunately, FISH is probably not the best technology to use. It doesn't screen every chromosome. It screens a limited number of chromosomes, and it's unfortunately subject to a lot of error so that you may be transferring abnormal embryos or not transferring good embryos mistakenly. So FISH is not probably ideal to use. Microarray testing is another sort of DNA-based testing method that is reliable and accurate and certainly something worth using. And then qPCR testing is even more thorough and it involves amplifying multiple regions of DNA within the chromosomes, the 22 autosomes plus the sex chromosomes, to look for extra or missing portions of those chromosomes. And at least at RNA, the qPCR technology here is 98% accurate, and it's pretty quick, too. It just has that four-hour window.
And microarray testing takes how long?
I'm not exactly sure. I couldn't tell you.
Is it a couple of days, though? Or is it like a day? Okay.
Yeah.
As I understood it, it was when microarray testing was the standard of care that most people were using. The issue was it was requiring people to freeze embryos.
Mm-hmm.
because you couldn't get the test results back in time to do a day 5 or morning of day 6 transfer. Or that was how I had understood that to be. But as we're saying now, there are actually some advantages perhaps of not doing the transfer on the same month you do the stimulation. So,
Correct.
But are there some advantages to doing a fresh transfer over a frozen transfer?
There are, I think, mainly related to patient and couple comfort and kind of speed to transfer. A lot of couples that come in obviously are anxious to become pregnant sooner rather than later, and a lot of people would prefer to have a fresh transfer for that reason. The other issue is that for a frozen embryo transfer cycle, a lot of times you will need to take intramuscular progesterone, whereas during a fresh cycle, vaginal progesterone suppositories will suffice. And the intramuscular progesterone, which is essentially a shot, is more painful than the vaginal suppository. So for that reason, also people sometimes prefer fresh over frozen.
Okay. One of the things worth talking about anytime we talk about infertility treatment is the issue of cost. We all know, or maybe longtime listeners of this show will know, many patients are paying for infertility treatment out of pocket because their insurance does not cover it, or because they've used up the number of cycles that their insurance does cover. So the more we add to the process, the more we raise the cost of the process. So it's worth talking about now, if utilizing PGD will increase the odds let's back up. Utilizing PGD will allow us to choose the best embryo, one would hope, therefore increase the odds of success for a pregnancy. But what does it do to the cost?
So it is an additional cost for a cycle to have chromosomal screening. However, this can be an additional cost up front, which potentially saves costs down the road, because it definitely lowers your chance of miscarriage, and it would also, at least theoretically, lower the number of transfers you would ultimately have to undergo in order to obtain a pregnancy. So if the live birth rate in women under 35 at our group without chromosome screening is 65%, but the rate of live birth in all comers with PGD screening is 85%, you can see that you would have to go through less cycles to obtain a child through if you're using PGD-screened blastocysts rather than simply the one that's judged the best-looking blastocyst for transfer.
Okay, so what does it do for the, and you may have just answered this, you were talking about live birth rate, so that probably incorporates the, I wanted to talk about statistics. So you're saying that the live birth rate, which should take into account the miscarriage rate, for under 35-year-olds, the research that you're seeing right now would say that it would increase it from 65% to 85%. Did I get that right?
Right. So the live birth rate in women under 35 at RMA is 65%. Now, the national average live birth rate for women under 35 is actually closer to 40%. But in women who undergo chromosomal screening, at least at our clinic, across the board, across all age groups, the live birth rate is 85%. So whether you're looking at that 65% versus 85% or even more profoundly at the 40% national average versus an 85% live birth rate, then your efficiency, your chance of having a baby per effort, per try, is higher with the chromosomally screened embryos.
In some of the research that was presented at ASRM this year, what were some of the other statistics in other clinics? What were they finding? Was it this dramatic as well? With PGD and chromosomal screening, were they finding as universally was 85 pretty much what we were hearing?
So I can't quote the I can't quote the PGD screening pregnancy rates for other clinics, but it does improve pregnancy rates across the board in other clinics as well to do the chromosomal screening.
Okay. And one of the things that we know is that fertility treatment in general is just less effective with older women, regardless of what we do. So for an older woman, over 35, and if you want to break it down to over 35 and then over 40, that would be fine. So for older women who are making fewer chromosomally normal embryos, do we see the same increase, the same pregnancy rates using their own eggs? Given that their eggs, they may not produce that many, what are the odds of finding in a given cycle a chromosomally normal embryo?
Absolutely. So that's a very important question also, I think. So actually, to first answer the question of whether women have a good older women or women over age 35 or over age 40 have a chance of a live birth using a chromosomally screened embryo, absolutely. In fact, having a chromosomally normal embryo largely negates the negative impact of patient age on the chance of pregnancy. So a woman that is 40 that has a chromosomally normal blastocyst is in a very good place and might even be in close to the same place as a 30-year-old woman that has an embryo for transfer. So still, if there is a chromosomally normal embryo, the pregnancy rate in older women is also, or the live birth rate in older women also approaches 85% per transfer. Now,
but
the question
you,
of...
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
You also said or mentioned that, you know, women who are older might not have quite as many embryos available per cycle, and that's true. And actually, there can be quite a bit of variability in the amount of embryos collected in women after age 35. While some might have 3 embryos after one cycle, some women might be struggling to have 1 embryo after a single cycle of IVF. And that certainly will influence the chance of pregnancy because the more you have, the better your chances of having a euploid or a genetically normal embryo. So,
exactly, because they produce, older women do not stimulate as well, so they produce fewer eggs to begin with, and then of the eggs they produce, fewer of them grow to the blastocyst stage. So I guess I'm trying to get a feel for if you were a typical 40-year-old coming in, what would be your chances, not of if you found a normal chromosome, because you said that's, at least at your clinic, 85% and high at other clinics as well, if you have a chromosomally normal embryo. But what are your chances in general of having a chromosomally normal embryo? And pick an age. Let's pick 40 for the sake of argument.
Absolutely. So I'm actually looking at it right here. So at age 40, the rate of aneuploidy is about 55%. So the number of embryos, so if you had 4 embryos, roughly half of them would be abnormal genetically and half would be normal.
Okay. So your risk obviously, the more eggs you produce and the more embryos that grow, the better your odds. You know, that would be that's a duh statement, but but your rate's about, you know, 40 to 55%, so just say roughly half. So you know, kind of going in, if you've got 4, you know, if you're playing the odds, yeah, you would have half of them. All right, although this is a little. Not directly on topic, it is something that comes up and is sometimes not mentioned but always thought by the general public or often wondered about the general public. In fact, I just heard, I believe, it was a Diane Rehm show on NPR recently. I'm a podcast addict. I love podcasts. And I listen to them when I run, and it was just yesterday. I was running and just was playing whatever was coming up, and it happened to be
cool.
A Diane Rehm show. And she was talking about the use of PGD to, and I think it was Diane Rehm, now that I'm saying it, I'm pretty sure it was her show, the use of PGD to create and the term that's always used by the media is designer babies. You've been discussing PGD to find chromosomally normal embryos. So the PGD is significantly looking at just to make certain that the numbers of chromosomes are correct and that so choosing those. How much further can you drill deeper, so to speak, in PGD to choose choose gender, to choose hair color, to choose eye color, to choose things that those would be considered more cosmetic, but to choose things like susceptibility to certain diseases. And things that parents might well have an interest in knowing about.
Absolutely, and that's actually a very important distinction. And a lot of people will confuse PGD with more specific, looking for more specific genetic traits. So actually, to state it correctly, PGD, or pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, is actually used to diagnose embryos that carry a very specific mutation or genetic trait. For instance, an embryo that might be affected by cystic fibrosis or spinal muscular atrophy, some very deadly diseases that you don't, or parents might not necessarily want to pass on to the next generation. So PGD in particular is truly used for that. On the flip side, PGS, or pre-implantation genetic screening, is really what we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes, where we're doing a broad look at the chromosomes to see if there are large pieces of missing or extra genetic information, which would really be used more to predict chance of a live birth or chance of miscarriage versus very specific genetic traits.
Okay, and I hear you, and that's a great distinction. I'm actually glad you mentioned it. Okay, so we have kind of general screening that we've been talking about for looking at, taking a big picture look and saying, does this embryo have the right number of chromosomes in order to give it the best chance of implantation? But the same technique, or a more specific technique, PGD, and that was the first one was pre-implantation genetic screening, but the second one, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, can also be used in hat in hand when you're doing PGS. So how often do you look further for either the specific diseases, and what diseases can be, and then even down to things, is it possible to look for cosmetic things?
Right, absolutely. So PGD and PGS are similar insofar as they involve biopsying the embryo. So, but actually, after that sample, those couple cells from the placenta is obtained, following that, the two techniques completely differ. So for the PGS, which we have been talking about up to this time, it involves qPCR testing, a broad look at all the chromosomes. For PGD testing, which actually can't be done in a short amount of time, it could never be done for a fresh embryo transfer, it is a much more involved process. It involves generating specific DNA probes surrounding a certain particular gene within the genome or within one chromosome to identify if that particular gene, for instance, the gene for cystic fibrosis, is mutated. So they're not something, they can be combined, but they're actually quite different in terms of their goal. So some couples may have a child with cystic fibrosis and they're looking to sort of screen against this in their second child. And in that case, they would do PGD testing. They would be looking specifically at that embryo's cystic fibrosis gene, and they could elect to do that in combination with broad genomic screening or PGS, or they may elect not to do the genetic screening at all, to do the testing for the cystic fibrosis, the PGD for the cystic fibrosis alone, but not look at the rest of the genome for other broad errors in the genetic code.
Gotcha. And the And the PG, in specific, PGD, looking for specific diseases, is not routinely done, and there may not even be research that would indicate that from a implantation, and the upping the odds of implantation and growth, we certainly may or may not be a particularly. It's not the reason that it is utilized.
Right, and it would be. People or couples do not routinely test for specific genetic disorders unless they are known to be carriers for that disorder. It wouldn't be reasonable at this stage to test for every single genetic mutation that could exist, because there are endless possibilities for specific genetic or gene changes that could occur.
So, and PGS has been a while, and in the past we've been referring to it as PGD, but we really should be more specific, because you're right, there really are two different things. PGS has been around for a while. So why is it making the buzz now for what has changed to make it more accurate or to make the reproductive endocrinologists that I've spoken with more excited about the future as far as predicting, increasing the odds of success? What's changed?
Absolutely. So it's a lot to do with the type of science, as you said, I think at the onset of the hour, the type of science which is kind of caught up with embryology and embryo selection. So in the past, the FISH type of diagnostics testing was not accurate or reliable and would often lead to false positives or negatives. Patients and physicians weren't as comfortable in using that. But now that we have microarray and also qPCR testing, this type of screening is much more accurate and reliable and offers a definite impact on the chance of live birth.
Which is really, I mean, it's kind of in some ways picking the, a long time ago, embryologist on the show talked about the Holy Grail. He said the Holy Grail would be being able to look at an embryo or test an embryo to know which ones will implant. But interestingly, this was probably in 2008, I guess, when he was on the show. And he said, but, you know, we are a long way away from that. And I suppose it depends on how we define long, but, you know, it doesn't feel that long anymore.
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of it is that the speed at which computers and technology is able to process information is so much faster now. That's what's facilitated the advent of qPCR and microarray. It's the ability of these computer systems, the technology, to process such a vast amount of information and give a reliable output, whereas FISH was more actually not sort of computer or technology-based so much as use of a staining material and then just looking visually at chromosomes plated out on a slide.
All right. We have a question from Bethany that seems relevant here, and she is concerned about the impact on an embryo for when you take a biopsy from the embryo. Her question's long, but I think that's a pretty valid summary. So what
Absolutely.
Does the research show on that?
So, you know, doing a biopsy is not completely risk-free, but the chance of damaging the embryo is essentially roughly 1% when it's done at the trophectoderm or at the blastocyst stage when you're taking placenta cells only. So, but there is a risk of approximately 1% that the embryo would not be able to survive the biopsy. But that risk is outweighed by the advantage you gain in knowing the genetic information and being able to determine which embryos to transfer.
Mm-hmm. And I would add, and I think we said this at the beginning of the show, I would add that this is not always, that part of her concern is based on some of the information that's a number of years old when the biopsies were done on a day three, and that's what you were speaking about at the beginning, that's taking 1 to 2, or say 2 out of 8 cells versus 2 out of 200. And I think that it may have been where I think there are some not misunderstanding, just where the information has, is only now percolating down, the research information, so people aren't really even aware that it's done at a different stage.
Absolutely, and one thing to add on top of that is that at the 8-cell stage, all of those cells could have the potential to become anything. They could be placenta, they could be baby, but at the blastocyst stage, we can clearly take from the placenta and not from the inner cell mass or the baby portion of the embryo.
What you're describing is a fairly sophisticated process, and this is not meant to be an advertisement at all for any particular lab. So I want this to be more general, regardless of where people live. What should people look for when choosing a infertility clinic? And one of the things we encourage people to consider when they're choosing a clinic is to look at the lab, because much of this the biopsying is being done by embryologists in the lab. So what should people look for when choosing, how do they tell, what questions should they ask of their clinics to know whether their labs are up to speed with the ability to do the chromosomal screening and doing it at the blastocyst stage?
Absolutely, and I agree with you 100% that the lab makes the practice. The better the embryologists are, the better the success of the program is. So one sort of strong indication of a good lab is the ability of that lab to culture most embryos to the blastocyst stage, which is day 5. So I think that at minimum, whether or not they do offer blastocyst culture and blastocyst transfer is important. Also to ask for the type of biopsy they do. Do they do trophectoderm biopsy or do they do cleavage stage biopsy, which is the 8-cell stage, or other types of biopsies, polar body biopsies, which may not be quite as reliable in terms of a screening test. And then overall, in general, the pregnancy and live birth rates, perhaps as reported through the SART website, Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology website, would be a good reference point to find a strong IVF clinic and IVF laboratory.
And we link to all of that, well, both the SART and the CDC. The information is the same. It's just that SART is 1 year sooner, 1 year more recent. We link to all those off of our How to Find an Infertility Clinic page, and we also have done a number of radio shows which focus on how to understand those statistics and interpret those statistics. So, and all of those shows are also listed on our How to Choose an Infertility Clinic. So, do some labs send out although they do the biopsying, they send out the tissue, the cells to be analyzed elsewhere. Does that happen some, or do most clinics, most labs do the actual screening in house?
It does happen a fair amount, and that's okay to do. Essentially, what happens is the embryo is cultured and grown in the laboratory. The biopsy is obtained, and then the embryo is frozen. And then that biopsy tissue can be either kept in-house to analyze or sent to another facility to analyze. And that is very much an okay practice. So it would depend in part on what that IVF clinic uses for their PGD screening.
Right. Would that be a question? From the average patient, they're not going to know whether it probably isn't an issue of importance, I suppose, because from an average patient standpoint, there's not a significant advantage between, other than a timing and the ability to do a fresh transfer, to
right.
using a for your, the lab to do it in house versus sending it out. So that's probably not something that we should add to our list of things to ask about, because good screening can be done either way. Although it would require.
Right.
I would imagine it would require, I guess if it happened in the, if the screening facility was located in the same geographic area, it's possible it could be done in the same day and still do an early, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I suppose it could be actually.
Potentially, but I would imagine most of the time it would require freezing, yeah.
Yeah, I would think it would as well. Possible, I suppose, that you could do it, you know, quick enough that you could get it back. But I mean, then you're really talking about a bit of a timing issue at that point. And as we said, there's not a huge advantage. In fact, there could even be a disadvantage to transferring fresh. So it's something to think about. Let me take a quick moment here to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show and all the resources at Creating a Family. We have Cryos International. They are a New York sperm bank, which are part of the world's largest international network of sperm bank. Cryos New York offers donor semen and semen storage services and the ability to ship specimen to more than 65 countries. We also have Nightlight Christian Adoptions with offices in California, Colorado, and South Carolina. They have they are known for their Snowflakes program, which is an embryo donation program, and they have had over 260 babies born. In fact, I think it's over 300 now, babies born through their embryo donation program. So I think our final question is going to be, do you foresee, or maybe it already has become the standard of practice, do you foresee genetic screening becoming part of the standard of practice in IVF?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, it is really key to optimizing outcomes for couples. And more than that, it also can make couples feel more comfortable in transferring fewer embryos, which would ultimately lead to a lower twin rate or multiple gestation rate, and therefore lead to safer pregnancies. So that if you transfer one chromosomally screened normal embryo, then you can have a pregnancy rate which is approximately equivalent to transferring two unscreened embryos.
And a significantly lower multiple birth rate, not zero, but because we can always have natural twinning. But I am so glad you raised that. I can't believe that I did not touch on that in this show already. We are huge proponents here at Creating a Family of encouraging single embryo transfer, and with the notion of, our mission is to try to say that IVF success in infertility treatment is one healthy baby. And so, yeah, I am so glad you mentioned that, because truthfully, the more we are able to assure people, because people, the reason they want twins, well, it's multiple reasons people want twins. Partly they've tried long enough and they're tired of not, and the idea of having an instant family is appealing. But there also is the concern that they want to increase their odds of having any baby. So I think those two things, we can't handle that. This doesn't address the fear of or the desire to have the instant family, but it does address the issue of increasing your odds that they become along the same line as transferring to. And
absolutely. And sorry to interrupt. Just one quick point to add to that is that if you have a series of embryos obtained through IVF, and you know two of them are chromosomally normal, it is equally effective to just transfer one at a time so that you could have the instant family, because you'd know that you're transferring one now, but you have one that's cryopreserved and waiting for a subsequent pregnancy at which time you're ready.
Yes. It's called having your twins 2 years apart, that type of thing. Yeah, I've
that's
heard
right.
That. Yeah. Which always makes you scratch your head on that one. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Marcy McGuire, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. I want to just do a shout-out now for our listeners. If you have enjoyed the show and want to help us grow, please rate this podcast on iTunes. You can go to our radio page of our site, creatingafamily.org/radioshow, and click on the iTunes button, and it will take you to the page where you can rate the show. Just click on the number of stars you want to give it, and we'd also very much appreciate any written comments you could leave. It helps others find our show, and that helps others, and so we appreciate that. If you want to participate in a discussion of the topic of this show, check out my blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog. To get more information on Dr. McGuire or on RMA New Jersey, you can go to their website, which is rmanj.com. Thanks for joining me this week, and I look forward to talking with you and hearing our show next week. Thanks.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it was pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.